I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
I know that my home was leveled, but where is it? Where is it? I cannot find it. What is this? What do we do with our lives? Where should we live? Where should we stay? A house of multiple floors, but nothing was left?
As a ceasefire begins in Gaza, tens of thousands of displaced Palestinians are streaming north to return to their homes, finding nothing but rubble as Israeli troops start pulling back. We'll get the latest on the ceasefire hostage deal with Palestinian attorney Diana Bhutu and analyst Amjad Araki, then to the Nobel Peace Prize.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Nobel Peace Prize for 2025 to Maria Corina Machado.
The Nobel Committee recognizes a leading U.S.-backed Venezuelan opposition leader. The announcement coming as Venezuela is fronting mounting threats from the Trump administration, which has repeatedly bombed boats off the coast of Venezuela. We'll talk to the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Greg Grandin. Then, the acclaimed writer Cory Doctorow, author of a new book, and Bleepification, Why Everything Suddenly Got Worse and What to Do About It.
And poopification is a theory that describes platform decay, how these platforms lock people in and then abuse them and become worse and worse, but we can't seem to leave them until they're just a giant pile of crap. And we've all experienced this decay of platforms that we relied on in so many ways.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Israeli government's approved the first phase of a Gaza ceasefire deal. It includes an exchange of the hostages held by Hamas in return for Palestinian prisoners held by Israel. Al Jazeera's reporting, Israeli forces in Gaza have started to retreat behind the lines agreed to under the deal. Tens of thousands of displaced Palestinians are streaming from the southern part of the Gaza Strip to the north. On Thursday, Hamas's exiled Gaza chief, Khalil al-Khaya, said all Palestinian women and children will be released and issued a statement declaring an end to the war.
Today we announce that we have reached an agreement to end the war and aggression against our people and to begin implementing a permanent ceasefire. The withdrawal of the occupation forces, the entry of aid, the opening of the Rafah crossing in both directions, and the exchange of prisoners.
It comes as President Trump announced the Israeli hostages will be released from Gaza on Monday or Tuesday. Under terms of the deal, 250 Palestinian prisoners serving life sentences and another 1,700 Gazans detained by Israel during the war will be released. Meanwhile, the U.S. is sending about 200 troops to Israel to monitor the ceasefire deal. This is Palestinian civil defense member Nur al-Shagoudmi, who joined celebrations Thursday in Gaza City.
Honestly, these are indescribable feelings. We can't believe it. But thank God the war has ended and we are alive. Honestly, we hope the war does not come back and for this to be really the end.
In Tel Aviv, Israelis gathered at the public plaza known as Hostages Square to celebrate news of the ceasefire. This is Udi Goren, cousin of an Israeli hostage, Tal Haimi, who is confirmed dead in Gaza and whose body is believed to be held by Hamas.
Bringing back the hostages is just the first phase of this deal. And rightfully so, finally prioritizing bringing them home in before anything else. But after we bring them all home, it's time to start rebuilding our future.
Meanwhile, Israeli Army Radio is reporting 600 aid trucks will be allowed to enter Gaza daily, coordinated by the United Nations and other international aid groups. Tom Fletcher is the UN's top emergency relief coordinator.
So here is what we plan to deliver in the first 60 days of the ceasefire. We will aim to increase the pipeline of supplies to hundreds of trucks every day. Food. We will scale up the provision of food across Gaza to reach 2.1 million people who need food aid and around 500,000 people who need nutrition. Famine must be reverted in areas where it has taken hold and prevented in others.
We'll have more on the Gaza ceasefire agreement later in the broadcast. A grand jury has criminally indicted New York Attorney General Letitia James after President Trump instructed Attorney General Pam Bondi to go after his political enemies, writing on X, quote, "We can't delay any longer. It's killing our reputation and credibility," Trump said. Lindsay Halligan, who President Trump installed to serve as U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Virginia, presented the case to the grand jury. Last month, Halligan secured charges against James Comey, the former FBI director. Trump forced out his previous U.S. attorney for refusing to bring charges against both Comey and James. This is Attorney General Letitia James.
This is nothing more than a continuation of the president's desperate weaponization of our justice system. He is forcing federal law enforcement agencies to do his bidding. And so today, I'm not fearful. I'm fearless.
The 2025 Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to the Venezuelan opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado. The Norwegian Nobel Committee announced its decision in a ceremony in Oslo earlier today.
She is receiving the Nobel Peace Prize for her tireless work promoting democratic rights for the people of Venezuela and for her struggle to achieve a just and peaceful transition from dictatorship to democracy.
In 2023, Machado launched a campaign to challenge incumbent President Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela's 2024 election. She was barred from running after the government accused her of corruption and cited her support for U.S. sanctions against Venezuela. Machado has vowed to privatize Venezuela's state oil industry. She's praised right-wing Latin American leaders, including Argentina's Javier Milei. In 2020, her opposition party, 20 Venezuela, signed a pact formalizing strategic ties with Israel's Likud party, led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Machado has said that if elected, she'll move Venezuela's embassy in Israel to Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. We'll have more on Maria Corina Machado later in the broadcast with the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Greg Grandin. The Nobel Peace Prize being awarded at a time when the U.S. bombed four boats off the coast of Venezuela, killing 21 people. Colombia's President Gustavo Petro said Wednesday the U.S. killed Colombians in one of the boats it bombed in the Caribbean for allegedly carrying drugs. In Peru, lawmakers swore in a new president, 38-year-old head of Peru's legislature, José Yeri, soon after voting unanimously to remove President Dina Boluarte. Her removal comes after months of deadly protests in rural Andean and indigenous communities. Rights groups accused Boluarte's government of using lethal force to suppress the protests. She was also enmeshed in a corruption scandal involving undeclared assets and watches. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent announced the U.S. has begun implementing parts of a bailout for Argentina by finalizing a $20 billion currency swap with Argentina's central bank. Argentina's far-right President Javier Milei is an ally of President Trump. On Thursday, eight Democratic senators introduced a bill that would prevent the Treasury Department from rescuing Argentina's economy. Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren said, quote, "It's inexplicable that President Trump's propping up a foreign government while he shuts down our own," unquote. In Washington, D.C., the federal government shutdown has entered its 10th day. On Thursday, President Trump said at a cabinet meeting he'll permanently cut programs approved by Congress during the shutdown, like billions of dollars in climate and infrastructure for Democratic-led states, adding, quote, "We're only going to cut Democrat programs," unquote. The White House has suggested furloughed federal workers may not receive back pay. On Thursday, House Speaker Mike Johnson ruled out advancing a standalone bill to pay the salaries and benefits of military members who are due to miss paychecks on October 15th. Meanwhile, Food and Water Watch reports if the shutdown continues into next week, 5.3 million children under the age of five will lose access to SNAP food assistance and benefits, with many likely to go hungry. That's on top of more than 2 million people set to lose some or all of their SNAP benefits under the budget reconciliation bill Trump signed in July. A federal judge in Chicago has issued a temporary restraining order against President Trump's deployment of hundreds of National Guard troops to Illinois after Chicago and state officials sued to block the move. U.S. District Judge April Perry said in an oral ruling Thursday, deploying soldiers would, quote, only add fuel to the fire that defendants themselves have started, unquote. The ruling came as Illinois' Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker once again accused Trump of overstepping constitutional limits on his authority.
At every turn that they've tried to militarize our cities. Indeed, look at what ICE and CBP are doing. They're wearing fatigues. They're carrying long guns, automatic weapons. They're coming to downtown. Come on, downtown Chicago, Michigan Avenue. What is the purpose of that? It's all a show.
Separately, another federal judge in Chicago ruled Thursday federal agents violated the constitutional rights of peaceful demonstrators, journalists, and religious leaders at recent protests against ongoing ICE raids. A lawsuit brought by victims of the ICE violence accuses federal agents of a pattern of extreme brutality, saying they tackled and slammed people to the ground and fired rubber bullets and pepper balls at peaceful protesters and working journalists. In her ruling, District Court Judge Sarah Ellis wrote, quote, individuals are allowed to protest. They're allowed to speak. That's guaranteed by the First Amendment of our Constitution, and it's a bedrock right that upholds our democracy, she said. Judge Ellis's temporary restraining order also requires all uniformed federal agents to prominently display identification like badge numbers on their uniforms or helmets. Meanwhile, in Tennessee, National Guard troops are scheduled to begin patrolling the streets of Memphis today over the objections of city officials. They'll add to a surge of federal law enforcement officers already in Memphis. Trump claims the deployment's aimed at quelling violent crime in the majority black city. On Thursday, Trump signaled he's prepared to send troops into even more cities.
And we're restoring law and order in our country. We're restoring it here, but we're restoring it right now. We're in Memphis. We're going to Chicago. We're going to other cities.
Oklahoma's Republican Governor Kevin Stitt has criticized the deployment of National Guard troops to Illinois. Stitt is the current chair of the National Governors Association. Speaking to the New York Times, he said, quote, Oklahomans would lose their mind if Pritzker in Illinois sent troops down to Oklahoma during the Biden administration, unquote. Stitt stated that President Trump should have first federalized troops already in Illinois. A Texas court has halted the execution of Robert Roberson, whose 2003 murder conviction over the death of his two-year-old daughter was based on the shaken baby syndrome theory, which has never been scientifically validated. On Thursday, a narrow 5-4 majority of Texas's Court of Criminal Appeals granted Roberson's request to stay his execution, citing a Texas law that allows for new trials in cases with flawed scientific evidence. The trial court that convicted Roberson will now consider whether he should be granted a new trial. Throughout his more than 20 years on death row, Roberson has always maintained his innocence. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's government has approved the first phase of the Gaza ceasefire deal that includes a pause in Israeli attacks and the release of the remaining hostages held by Hamas in exchange for Palestinians detained in Israeli prisons. President Trump announced yesterday the Israeli hostages will be released from Gaza on Monday or Tuesday as he plans to travel to the Middle East. According to the deal, 250 Palestinian prisoners serving life sentences and another 1,700 people from Gaza detained in the last 2 years would be released. Hamas has demanded the release of prominent Palestinian political prisoner Marwan Barghouti, but his name was reportedly secretly removed from the prisoner exchange list by Israel. Meanwhile, the U.S. is sending about 200 troops to Israel to monitor the ceasefire deal. The Israeli military Friday confirmed the ceasefire had come into effect as soldiers retreated from parts of Gaza. Tens of thousands of Palestinians, including families that had been forced to the south, began their trek back to northern Gaza after news that Israeli forces were withdrawing. Returning Gaza City residents made their way through mounds of rubble and destroyed neighborhoods, searching for any sign of their homes and belongings, among them Vidal Haraz.
I came since the morning when they said there was a withdrawal to find my home. I'm walking in the street, but I do not know where to go due to the extent of the destruction. I swear I don't know where the crossroads is or where my home is. I know that my home was leveled, but where is it? Where is it? I cannot find it. What is this? What do we do with our lives? Where should we live? Where should we stay? A house of multiple floors, but nothing was left?
Al Jazeera reports Israel's army said it would allow 600 humanitarian aid trucks carrying food, medical supplies, fuel, and other necessities daily into Gaza through coordination with the United Nations and other international groups. On Thursday, the exiled Hamas Gaza chief, Khalil al-Haya, declared an end to the war.
Today, we announce that we have reached an agreement to end the war and aggression against our people and to begin implementing a permanent ceasefire. The withdrawal of the occupation forces, the entry of aid, the opening of the Rafah crossing in both directions, and the exchange of prisoners.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke today in Israel.
Today we mark one of the greatest achievements in the war of revival, the return of all of our hostages, the living and the dead as one. This way we grapple Hamas. We grapple it all around, ahead of the next stages of the plan, in which Hamas is disarmed and Gaza is demilitarized. If this can be achieved the easy way, very well. If not, it will be achieved the hard way.
In the United States, President Trump hailed his administration's ceasefire plan during a cabinet meeting Thursday as concerns mount regarding potential U.S. and foreign intervention in the rebuilding of Gaza.
Gaza is going to be slowly redone. You have tremendous wealth in that part of the world by certain countries, and just a small part of that, what they make will do wonders for Gaza.
For more, we're joined by two guests. In Haifa, Diana Bhutu, Palestinian human rights attorney, former advisor to the negotiating team of the Palestine Liberation Organization. She's just recently written a piece for The Guardian. It's headlined, "A Magic Pill Made Israeli Violence Invisible. We Need to Stop Swallowing It." And I'm Judd Araki, is a senior Israel-Palestine analyst at the International Crisis Group, joining us from London. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Diana Bhutu, let's begin with you. First, your response to this ceasefire hostage deal that's just been approved by the Israeli government and Hamas.
Well, first, Amy, it's really quite repulsive that Palestinians have had to negotiate an end to their genocide. It should have been that the world put sanctions on Israel to stop the genocide rather than forcing Palestinians to negotiate an end to it. At the same time, we're also negotiating an end to the famine, a famine that Israel, again, created. Who are we negotiating with? The very people who created that famine. And so it's really repugnant that this is the position that Palestinians have been forced to be in. And so while people here are elated, happy that the bombs have stopped, we're also at the same time worried because we've seen that the international community time and again has abandoned us. Everybody is happy that the Israelis are going home, but nobody's talking about the more than 11,000 Palestinians who are currently languishing in Israeli prisons, being starved, being tortured, being raped. Many of them are hostages picked up after October of 2023, being held without charge, without trial, and nobody at all is talking about them. So while people are happy that the bombs have stopped, we know that Israel's control has not at all stopped. And Israel's made it clear that it's going to continue to control every morsel of food that comes into Gaza. It's going to control every single construction item that comes into Gaza. And it's going to continue to maintain a military occupation over Gaza. This is not a peace agreement. This is not an end to the occupation. And I think it's so important for us that we keep our eyes on Gaza and start demanding that Israel be held to account, not only for the genocide, but for all of these decades of occupation that led to this in the first place.
Can you talk about the exchange of hostages, Israeli hostages dead and alive, and Palestinian prisoners? According to the Hamas Gaza chief, I believe they're saying all women and children, Palestinian women and children picked up over these last 2 years, or is it beyond, are going to be released. And then, of course, there are the well over 1,000 prisoners who are going to be released.
No, not quite. So there are 250 who are political prisoners who are going to be released. And that list just came out about a little over an hour ago. But there are also 1,700 Palestinians solely from Gaza who are going to be released. And these were people, these are doctors, these are nurses, these are journalists and so on, who Israel picked up after the 7th of October, 2023, and has been holding as hostages. These are the people that are going to be released. There are still thousands more, Amy, that are from the West Bank that we do not know what is going to happen to them. And so while the focus is just on the people in Gaza, and again, there is no path for freeing all of those thousands of Palestinians who are languishing in Israeli prisons, being starved, being tortured, being raped. What's going to happen to them? Who's going to be focusing on them? I don't think that it's going to be this U.S. administration.
I want to talk about the West Bank in a minute. More than 1,000 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank just over the last 2 years. But I first want to get Amjad Araki's response to this deal that has now been signed off on. I mean, watching the images of tens of thousands, this sea of humanity, of Palestinians going south to north to see what they can find of their homes in places like Gaza City, not to mention who's trapped in the rubble. We say something well over 60,000 Palestinians have been killed, but we don't know the real number. It could be hundreds of thousands.
Indeed, Amy. And to kind of continue off of Deanna's points, this is a deal that really should have been made long, long ago. We've known that the parameters of this truce have been on the table for well over a year, if not since the very beginning of the war, what used to define as an all-for-all deal, the idea that Hamas would release all hostages in exchange for a permanent ceasefire. And the reasons for the constant foiling of it are quite evident. And it's important to recognize this, not for the sake of just lamenting the lives, the many lives that have been lost and the massive destruction that could have been averted, but it needs to really inform the next steps going forward. The biggest takeaway of what's happening right now is that in order for a ceasefire to be sustained, in order for Gaza to be saved from further military assault, you need massive political pressure. And we've seen this really build up in the past weeks and months. You saw this, for example, from European governments, which, even through the symbolic recognition of Palestinian statehood, was very much venting their frustration with Israeli conduct in the war. The fact that the EU was actually starting to contemplate more sort of punitive measures against Israel, such as partial trade suspensions, potential sanctions against Israel. We saw this building up over the past few weeks. Arab states, have started to use much of their leverage, especially after Israel's strike on Doha, or Hamas's offices in Doha. We started seeing Gulf and other Arab and Muslim states come forward to President Trump at the UN, saying that Israeli aggression cannot continue like this. And most crucially is, of course, President Trump himself and of Washington finally saying that it needs to put its foot down to stop this war, which we've heard repeatedly from Trump himself, but this is really the first time since the January ceasefire agreement where Trump has really insisted that this come to an end. Now there's much to be sort of debated about the Trump plan itself, but this aspect of the truce cannot continue and certainly cannot save Palestinian lives unless that pressure is maintained. The concern now is that that pressure will recede or alleviate because there's now a deal that's signed. But actually, in order to enforce it, that pressure really needs to be maintained.
What do you think was the turning point, Amjad? The bombing of Qatar? Now, I mean, the New York Times had an expose that Trump knew before, not just in the midst of the bombing, that Israel was bombing their ally to try to kill the Hamas leadership. But do you think that was the turning point?
This really might have expedited, I think, a lot of factors that were already building up. As I said, pressure had been mounting against Israel for quite a while. There was really outrage, not just at the continuance of the military assaults, but the policy of starvation, which was very evident on the ground, and Israel's complete refusal to let in aid, its failed project through the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. So this had all been building, but I do think the strike on Doha really pushed Arab states to say that enough is enough, to see them really meet all together with President Trump and create a bit more of a united position to insist that this really couldn't go on, I think has really signaled that Israel really crossed a certain line geopolitically. Now, of course, that line should have been recognized as being crossed well before because of the facts on the ground in Gaza. But I do think that this has helped to kind of push things over the edge a bit more assertively. There are also speculations about Trump, of course, trying to have his name in for the Nobel Peace Prize and potentially other factors. But I do think that the timing of this, again, regardless of what ended up pushing it over the line, it is unfortunate that it has really taken this long. And it's really up to global powers and foreign governments to recognize that in order to make sure that this stays, that they really need to keep that pressure up.
And Amjad Araki, the core demand of the ceasefire is that Hamas disarm and end its rule. What security guarantees is Hamas seeking for its own members to lay down their arms and not face a wave of arrests or assassinations? How is this going to work? And talk about who you see running Gaza.
So these things are still a bit unclear. So throughout the ceasefire talks, Hamas has kept insisting about the idea of U.S. guarantees that Israel will not end the war. But there's never really any clear, concrete way to prove this. And as we've seen before, like in the January ceasefire deal and in much of the ceasefire talks, even if President Trump expresses his desire to see an end to the war, oftentimes he would still hand the steering wheel to Prime Minister Netanyahu. And if Netanyahu decided that he wanted to thwart the ceasefire talks, if he wanted to relaunch military assaults with, and the Israeli military and the government would back it, then Trump and Washington would fall into line and amplify those calls. And even President Trump himself would sort of cheer on the military assaults. And so this factor has certainly weighed a lot on Hamas. But I do think there's a combination of pressure, the fact that Arab states have insisted on Hamas to try to show, at least signal, certain flexibility, even though many of its demands have been quite consistent throughout the war. But the fact that I think Hamas is now feeling that there's also a bit more pressure on Israel to actually ensure that they at least tried to take the gamble that they will not return to war. And in regards to decommissioning and disarmament, publicly Hamas has placed a red line around this right to bear arms. But historically and even recently, they do say that they are willing to have conversations about decommissioning as long as it's tied to a political framework, especially one that's tied to the establishment of a Palestinian state. Now, one can really debate how much this process is actually quite feasible. And obviously, the Israeli government and much of the Israeli public is quite adamant in its opposition against Palestinian statehood, but Hamas may at least offer some space for those conversations to be had. There are discussions about it potentially giving up what it might describe as its larger or more offensive weaponry, like rockets or anti-tank missiles. And there's bigger questions around firearms, but I think it's important to put this question not as a black and white issue, as something that has to come first in the political process, as Israel is demanding, but one that requires trust building and confidence building in the rubric of a process of Palestinian self-determination. This is important not just in the case of Palestine, but across many conflicts around the world where the question of decommissioning, about establishing one rule, one gun, one government for a society, requires that kind of process. So it shouldn't just be a policy of destroying and military assaults and so on. You do need to engage in these questions in good faith.
There's so many questions, Yanibutu, and this first stage of the ceasefire hostage deal is really